Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to Sequentia. That is your DNA set to music. Well, welcome back.
You're done.
Hello? Somebody just said something. I didn't hear him. Sort of, kind of. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Sound Health Options. July 25th, 2010. We're being brought to you from the studios of Sound Health and the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology. We're the largest alternative research center in Ohio, and our research centers around vocal profiling and low-frequency sound presentation as a diagnostic and treatment modality to help the body obtain optimal health. We create and distribute software for health freedom. Our guest has arrived. I am going to turn on her microphone. We'll introduce her in just a moment. But I want to do a couple of things. Richard's with us today. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. A pleasure.
Hello.
As always.
We'll do a few
updates. I can
updates.
Hear you.
Can you tell them what you've posted for them?
I've already posted the information about the that great press release about the Corexit, and I see other links in the Blog Talk Radio chat room. Now can you hear me? Was I not there before?
I can hear you now, but there's
okay.
Some click.
Huh. Odd.
No, that's
not
so
not the
I
right
posted
number.
Hello, you're on the air. Well, our Daphne, she hung up on us because this was not the right number. Do you have a way to call her, Shannon, and get her back? And Richard and I will just go ahead and talk and let her know that she was on the air. You said you posted a press release.
Yes, I posted that fabulous press release about I'm very excited about this, that we had talked last week or the week before about some of the issues going on down in the Gulf, and that you had come up with these great frequencies to, how I will use the phrase, counterbalance or balance out the effects of the Corexit, which is the dispersant that they used and are using in the Gulf to theoretically make the droplets of the oil smaller. It does do that, but it also causes it drop down lower into the water is another effect of it, which is not good because it's harder to clean up. And it was also having effect the workers that were doing cleanup, and even here in the press release, you have a photograph of somebody wearing a hazmat suit and doing cleanup, which looks more like it's in the Alaskan cleanup than it is in the cleanup from here. And part of the issue was that initially, BP may have changed this, but I know for a period of time, BP was telling workers that if they were found wearing any kind of hazmat equipment, that they would be fired because they didn't want the press taking photographs of people doing cleanup as if it was really horribly hazardous. And as a byproduct of that.
It looks like it is. I have to interrupt you for a moment. Our guest is back with us on the line. Her mic is open. She does have the right phone number. Daphne, we will be with you in just
I'm so happy to hear you.
We will be with you in just a few minutes. I sent my assistant to go call you, so if there's a tap-in on your line, just ignore it. Richard,
all right, I'm right here.
Here, Richard is with us. He's my co-host, and we have a couple of announcements that we're talking about, and we'll be right with you and your exciting book. So just hold
Wonderful.
On. Okay.
Good morning, Daphne. This is Richard.
Good morning, Richard.
Hi.
That press release, we used the word countervail, and that
countervail, yes.
Yeah, we had to use that. Our attorney insisted. We put out the frequencies to countermand the swine flu last year and got in a bit of trouble because it sort of sounded medical, and we're not allowed to sound medical, so he came up with this word, countervail. So when we put out these frequencies to countervail, which just means counter and turn them around, the oil spill, you know, they're claiming there wasn't a problem. But here they stand in a hazmat suit.
Exactly. And some of the, that's what I was starting to say, is that some of the effects for people listening, some of the I won't use the term side effects, I'll just say effects of using the Corexit for people who are bringing it in and exposed to it is that they were having flu-like symptoms, they were having asthmatic, you know, reactions, they were actually having, some people are actually vomiting up blood because it's so, because one of the actions, at least to a mucous membrane, and this is true of sea life and people, is that it's a corrosive to the mucous membranes. So to sea life, it's really horrible, and to the people working on the shores that are inhaling the vapors as a byproduct of this horrible dispersant, it's really horribly corrosive and irritating to the mucosa. So they were having really bad reactions, and Sherry and I talked about this, and you've come up with these amazing countervailing tones to balance.
And every tone there is about wet, moist epithelial tissues and lungs. A and a D sharp, and both of these need to be used together. For those of you who are going to use it in a Rife machine, use the sounds together, A and D sharp, E and A sharp. And on the grid that's in that article, it color codes those, so it shows you what frequencies must be used together. Whoever created this poison was very smart about it in terms of the research that we do, because the antidotes to each of these create the other toxin. But you can get around that by using the two frequencies together. Or if any of you want to know about how to do it bioacoustically, we'll be glad to talk to you. You can get in touch with me at Sherry, S-H-A-R-R-Y, on air, Sherry on air, at gmail.com. Just a few more announcements because we have our guest waiting. There's an update on the Guardian Network. That's the network where we create software for health freedom. And this month we put out a muscle program for our members and help them look at muscles for training or exercise or team sports. We will be doing another class this month, and it's for the Guardian members, and it's going to be another class on marketing, not the same one we just did, but a different kind of a marketing class. Okay, thank you, Nelson, for that video on Obama where he was insulting a Michigan representative, Pete Hoekstra. We'll be bringing that up to you next week. I did an evaluation of it. You'd be very surprised at his intention. We also posted one of a political thing, and we're not supposed to mix, but I'm going to tell you about this anyway, on YouTube about Nancy Pelosi. And we entitled it Nancy Pelosi, Queen of, I think, Huff and Puff, because what she was saying was not not true. We're not broadcasting this week. We'll be returning to that next week. Richard has posted three items for you at drop.io/nanovoice, and we've put all of these links in the chat, so just go look at them and grab them there. I was going to look and see how many hits we had posted on that site, see how many people had looked at that article, but I didn't go do that, so I can't tell you that. Okay, we have a special announcement for next week, a surprise announcement, so we hope that you will be joining us for that. I'm going to open the microphone of our guest. She is Daphne Rose Kingman. She's been on Oprah 6 times. Boy, that should tell you she's a neat person. She's written several books. She is the undisputed expert on matters of the heart, author of 10 books on love and relationships, including The Future of Love, The Power of Soul in Intimate Relationships. Here's one, The Men We Never Knew. That sounds like a good one. Dubbed the Love Doctor by the San Francisco Chronicle, talks about her being on Oprah and how fabulous that was. She appears on numerous TV radio networks, and I'm very happy to have her with us. Welcome, Daphne, to the show.
Thank you, Sherry. It's wonderful to be with you, and I've just been listening to you and Richard talking about these terribly important things. Thank you for the beautiful work you're doing and bringing this awareness to us.
Well, we think that people can handle the idea of self-health, and that's the same options you're providing to them in your book. It's all about how to cope, and we certainly need that.
And yes.
You send out announcements to about 5,000 people that you were going to be on the show, and we started to get back questions. People were asking what to do about things out of their control. So we invite questions by email, sherryonair@gmail.com. And also we are going to be reading some of the questions that have already been sent in. We invite our listening audience to ask a question, or you can also go to our chat line, which is on Blog Talk Radio. At the bottom of the show, I think it's a big green arrow or something. I don't know what it appears on your guys. It's a big sort of splash of green on the bottom of mine. So you can write your questions there. You can call us at 347-850-1407. 347-850-1407. Or go to the chat. Or write to me at sherryonair, S-H-A-R-R-Y. This is a wonderful book. I love the color, the green of it, and the trees, and it's like a forever thing with the trees. Why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote it in response to what I've certainly been hearing from all the people that I'm working with, that, you know, these are very hard times and people are going through, it seems like, more of a pile-on of difficult things than I've observed in many recent years. And then very much in response to a friend of mine who was going through a whole lot of difficult things and came to visit me kind of to rest and recover, and on his way back home said to me, you know, Daphne, make me a list of 10 things that I need to do to get through all this. And so his request really became the personal inspiration. I've always found with my books that it's in response to somebody who says, you know, write me a book and tell me how to love well in a relationship, or write me a book and explain this mysterious gender called men to me. So I've always been inspired by a personal request, and that was true once again, but I felt like this man was speaking for so many people that are going through hard times.
Well, it sounds like you've been doing this for a while.
I've been at this for a while, yes. I think this is my 12th or 13th book, and It's about, I don't know, 18, 19 years that I wrote my first book, which is called Coming Apart, of course. So, yes, I hear the person who's asking the question, and I feel like, you know, that person so often is speaking for many others.
Well, I'd like to start with a very simple question. You know,
yes.
For some people, a hangnail is just chaos in their life. And then on the other side, you have the death of a spouse or a parent. How do we decide what's really chaos? And
I think there are hypochondriacs and people that are always complaining about whatever, and I think they know who they are and we know who they are. But a real crisis situation in life is either a hugely devastating event, like the death of a spouse or the loss of a job or the loss of your house, or it's a combination of many events that are, you know, stacked up together. And as with this friend of mine who came to see me, his wife had left. He lost his apartment where he lived. He lost his job, and he'd just been diagnosed with a progressive illness. And so it was all the combination of all these things. And I think the real nature of a true life crisis is when you feel so overwhelmed emotionally and functionally that you just don't know how to, you know, start moving in the process of dealing with it. It feels like it's bigger than you are.
So when somebody comes to you, is that where you start? How big of a crisis is this?
Well, I think they are usually saying that, you know, it feels overwhelming to me, and, you know, I feel powerless, and I don't know how to take the first step. I mean, I guess I want to make the distinction again. I think we all know people that the hangnail is a crisis, and the hangnail is always going to be the crisis. But then we know people and we know ourselves about when things are really big. It's more than a bad hair day. It's more than having to wait a couple of hours for an airplane that's late when you're going to get to your destination. It's more than having a little argument with your spouse. It's something that you realize is going to change your life or has the capacity to change your life, and you have to deal with it some way. It's like bigger than your current circumstances can handle.
Well, when you talk about this, I see this elephant in the zoo just kind of swaying back and forth, like I don't know what the next step is. I'm so angry.
Yes, that's a good image.
Get this energy.
And I think the nature of these crisis situations is that we are so overwhelmed. We're overwhelmed emotionally because we're in very deep emotional waters. You know, this is going to, you know, take my heart apart or take my dignity apart. And we're also in a situation where we've got to make a lot of practical decisions. It's like, what am I going to do? What is the first step? And so the reason I felt so inspired to offer this book is that in that situation where people are immobilized, it's like if somebody says, and that's what I've intended to offer here, okay, do this and do this and do this, try this and try this and try this, because if you do each of these things, and especially if you do all of these things, you will end up having lived through your crisis, and you will end up in a different place than you were when you stood staring it in the face and feeling totally paralyzed.
Like going through a tunnel and coming to the light on the other side.
Exactly, exactly. And sometimes when you're at one end of the tunnel and you can't see the light, you don't even know how to take the first step. So I wanted to offer these, you know, steps. It's like, yes, step into the tunnel because there is a light at the other end of it, even though you can't see it now.
Well, I want to talk about these steps, but the questions are starting to come in, and there's one that doesn't have much to do with anything we're talking about, but there is an interest in it being answered. What's it
well,
like?
Well, I'm happy to answer questions. I'm very happy to do that.
Okay, I'm going to look at these and try to get some that are sort of examples of the rest of them. But the first one, what's it like being on Oprah?
People always ask me that. It's a wonderful, powerful experience to know that you're speaking to so many people at one time, and it's a wonderful experience to be in the presence of this very powerful, very humanly concerned woman who is really concerned about the issues of the day and what troubles people and how to make a difference in the world. So it's a wonderful experience. I feel very privileged that I've been able to do it a number of times.
Well, we have a question from our chat room, and it's a question about how do we handle things out of our control. And she asks, Americans are being ruined by globalist control of our food. And she didn't really ask for an answer, but it's like, I would guess,
these are things obviously that I've addressed in the book, which is, first of all, the nature of a crisis is that you are out of control and you feel out of control. And the first thing is to go through the emotions about that, which we can talk about later. But one of the very important things is in this situation, because things are out of control, you're being asked to do something different. You're being invited to do something that you've never thought of doing before. And yes, it's true, you know, whatever the situation, it invites creativity. What does this mean? Does this mean you should grow your own organic garden? I have a friend who started an organic seed business, and this is his spiritual work, and it's his financial life now. It's his personal business because of this very question that, you know, that we're being asked right now. But it takes creativity and courage to do that. It's like we can't just sit there and say, well, everything's out of our control. We have to say, what in this situation can I creatively do that is maybe something I've never thought of doing before?
Well, I think if we take your 10 steps, one, cry for humanity, cry for what's happening, be concerned for humanity, but find a creative way to be a part of the solution.
Exactly, exactly. And that's true on a personal level. You know, we have to be creative about our own lives, but it's also true on a global level. And I just received an amazing video on YouTube from a young man that I know who started a business, and he's, you know, he's concerned that, you know, many of the dollars from his very successful business are dedicated to solving the problem of world hunger. You know, it's not like, well, I'm here making piles of money, but I'm supporting myself, I'm supporting these creative artists, and I'm also putting a certain number of dollars of every dollar that is made by this business towards solving the problem of world hunger. So it does work on a personal level and on a global level, if we choose to make that commitment, of course.
My mom used to say, you can't do more than you can do, but where do you draw that line? You're going to run yourself crazy by trying to do everything and feeding everybody. Is this something your book would address, where you draw that line of what you can do and what you
can't? Well, I think that self-awareness, which is one of my great teachings, the more self-aware you are, of course, the more you pay attention to that. And one of the things that is required in times of crisis is that you do be very self-caring, you know, you take care of yourself. And so, you know, part of that, one of the chapters talks about going to where you are supported and loved, and that's part of self-care. It's not just, okay, we're going to run ourselves ragged and run ourselves into the ditch, but having discretion about that and saying, okay, what can I do that is both helpful to me and also self-loving?
I think the lady probably means from, I'm trying to read the whole email, I could, or she could, sell everything she has and give it to World Hunger, but it still wouldn't be enough. So you
That's
have to-
right. And so I think each of us has to search our own hearts and say, what is the partial contribution that I can make? It's like this young man was saying, he's not saying, I'm going to go starve and live in a tent. He's saying, I'm using my creative talents and I'm using part of my resources to contribute. And I think the more all of us contribute a part, then it doesn't become an overwhelming burden for any one person.
Now, here's one. I'm going to try to cut it down. It's a crier. She was with a teacher that tried to teach live only love, but she said she took her last money to go to this workshop, but love doesn't feed her kids. There's more
well,
to it.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think, again, there are a lot of I address this in the book in the second chapter, which talks about really about being self-aware. You know, if you have children that you're responsible for and you have to feed them, and if you, you know, desire to live love or go to a personal retreat or everything, anything like that, you have to balance those things. And I think some of us have been blind. We know that many people in the United States have been blind to the fact that you can't, for example, buy a $500,000 house on a $17,000 a year income. It's just not, that's what a lot of people learned recently. We were living in fairyland. And so one of the things that I'm really talking about in this book, especially in chapter 2, which is called Facing Your Defaults, is becoming self-aware. How are you responding to life? Are you responding in a realistic, helpful way? Or are you responding in a way that throws caution to the wind and creates more problems? You know, if you have children to feed, you're not going to give all your money away so that your children starve. But there's, again, it's a matter of concerned self-awareness that we all need to develop, and crisis really invites us to do that. What do you need to pay attention to that you haven't been paying attention to? How can you change your behavior and do something different that will create a different solution?
I had an answer or something I wanted to ask to that, but I'm trying to read emails at the same time.
A lot going on.
There comes a time when you just have to say, this is my boundary, and I can't go any further than this.
Yes, that's right.
And there's a point when you're enabling other people. I have a grandson that keeps coming to me for money, and finally I said to him, just because I have money, I'm not obligated to give it to you. And he looked like I'd slapped him.
Right.
But he really felt whatever I had, I was obligated, so I had to make that boundary.
Yes. And I think, Sherry, you're talking about something that I've really taught very carefully in this book about facing what I call our defaults, which is the habitual way we respond. I mean, it sounds like you've responded with a lot of generosity to this young man, and then there's a certain point in which you say, you have to ask yourself, is this still the best way to respond, or do I need to respond differently? And it sounds like you got very clear that you did need to respond differently, and that's, I'm sure, a blessing for him in many ways, because he will learn something. And it's a new path for you, too.
It felt good to do it. I think I've just got an email in that will talk about your ideas of letting go. She says her husband is having an affair, a new baby with the other woman is involved. This affair has gone on for 3 years. I didn't have a clue. I feel so stupid. He professed to love me, but how could he? You don't love someone and do this to them. Dr. Laura says, just stay put and he'll come back. I have 3 other children. We lost our house. He doesn't care. We're living with friends, but they have limited resources, too. I had a good job. He wanted me to quit. He insisted that I quit going to church. Boy, there's a lot of things in here. I tried going back to church and talked to their counselor. I've cried until there's nothing left. I have a low-paying job now with no hope of a better one in this economy. I've looked for another job but have been turned down. I work 2 jobs trying to keep up. I had to go to court to get child support. It's been 2 years in court. They're still dragging this on. I'm at the end of my rope. What is the next step? And it's the
Well, this woman is definitely in a crisis, and my heart deeply goes out to you. And I think, as you suggested, Sherry, you know, there's some letting go required here, and it's really amazing how when we let go of something, the universe brings new things into us. It's like, and perhaps this listener has not really emotionally let go of her husband in a way that's saying, okay, I really am here, and I have to create a new life. I have to do something different. I don't believe it that there's no other job available, and I don't believe it that there's no other opportunity available. I think it may not be here tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, but there is, and sometimes, in fact, very often, it's true that the new opportunity does not show up until you've let go of something, and sometimes that's an emotional letting go. Sometimes it's a circumstantial letting go of saying, you know, okay, I accept that this is never going to change. I accept that this marriage is over. You know, I'm not going to emotionally hang on. I would strongly suggest to this woman that she get this book and read it, because there are many steps there, and I think they will bring a lot of encouragement to you and clarity to you and inspiration. That's my hope and intention. But I think the letting go part is very hard for us, because we're all kind of trained to want what we always had, want things the way they were, and we just, you know, it's very natural to hang on to what we've had. It's hard to let go. It's kind of against our natural instincts, and so that's one of the reasons that letting go is one of the chapters. It talks about the power that comes to you when you do have the courage to let go. So I hope that's helpful, and I hope that you can get the book and, you know, really let it guide you through the process, which I think it will.
The book we're talking about, The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart, and it is on sale at Amazon, 4.5 stars, and I think it's on sale for $10 and something from 14, so that's a good deal. I want to say two things about this woman. That she puts one sentence in here. He professes to love me, but how could he? You don't love someone and do this to them. Now, if she's listening to him and thinking he loves me, he's going to come back, this is just a phase, then he's keeping her dangling, even though...
Yes, exactly. And she's allowing herself to be dangled, you know. I mean, somebody once said many years ago, one of my clients, I thought it was a great expression, she said, don't listen to what their mouth says, look at what their feet do. His mouth is saying one thing, but clearly his behavior is saying something just completely opposite. And behavior is very significant in relationships. We can all say a lot of nice things, you know. It's easy to say nice things. I love you, I love you, I love you. But when you look at a person's behavior, that really tells you what the truth of their feeling is and where their commitment is.
I feel like from her letter, and this is just my feeling about it, that he's just trying to hedge his bets. If something breaks up with this new, well, it's not new, it's 3 years old, with that woman, then he wants the old one, I shouldn't say the old one, the previous one to be there waiting for him. So
yes, that's right, because he's having a hard time letting go too. And I think this story illustrates how just psychologically and emotionally difficult it is for us to let go, and that is especially true of relationships. I guess I want to say here also that I'd like to recommend to this woman my book called Coming Apart, which is Coming Apart, Why Relationships End and How to Live Through the Ending of Yours. I think that would be an extremely very specifically helpful book for this woman, and that too, of course, is available on Amazon. And let me just mention my website, because all these books are listed there. It's www.daphnekingma.com, and then KINGMA. There isn't an N on it. It's just KINGMA.com. I have two names that are really hard to spell. You know, there is a big letting go that is required here. And when somebody is keeping you dangling, you know, you kind of wish they'd let you go, because then it would be over. You'd have to cry about it and be upset. But the truth is, sometimes we have to initiate that letting go ourselves and say, okay, enough already. I see what you're doing. You're not here with me. Your words are not true. And I am letting go of you, because there's a future waiting for me, and I'm going to start walking into it.
Do you believe that somebody could treat somebody this way and still love them?
No, I believe this is a very self-involved person who is scared of letting go and doesn't know the true nature of love.
So he's a bum.
Well, I won't say that, but I think he's certainly a person who's very self-indulgent and not, you know, he doesn't know the true meaning of love and what the behaviors of love are, because love is not a bunch of fancy words you toss around. It's a lot of behavior that you do in behalf of another person.
Okay, we have another question. This one is not signed, so I don't know who it's from. I'm in a situation with my ex involving the visitation of our kids. I am trying to see both sides of our situation and make the best decision for all of us. He's a good father, and I want our time with them to be equal. He is panicking and won't even think about talking the issues over in a civil manner. I'm thinking about him and the kids and what would be best for all of us. How do I get that fact through to him when he is feeling like he is in crisis so that we can work together to make the best of what we have to work with?
That's a little complicated. I'm not sure if the husband, X, is in crisis because he doesn't want to see the children and he isn't aware that he should. I mean, the exact issues aren't clear to me. But I think that, you know, one thing is that sometimes when people have difficulty talking about things, verbally communicating, sometimes you can just write a note and say, here's an idea I had, or what's scaring you about this. You know, you can start a conversation through writing that sometimes people are afraid to have. I can't tell from what this woman has said what the specific issues are. You know, is the guy scared? Does he live in another town? Does he not have enough money? Is he afraid he's a bad father? Does he not want to see his wife with her new boyfriend? I don't know what the issues are. But I think that when there's difficulty communicating, very often a good thing is to, you know, communicate by mail. And also, if there's any verbal communication, to ask the other person, what is your problem? Not in a, you know, challenging, intense way, but what is frightening about this for you, or what do you need about this? Because sometimes we're very invested in getting our own thing. Well, I want it to be this way, I want it to be this way, I want it to be this way. And we're not seeing what is true for the other person. So that might be, you know, an avenue of verbal communication to explore, or if not, to do it in writing and see if that brings a clearer response.
I think as I read this over, what she's really, the issue is really about he won't talk the issue over and come. You know, and I've seen that before where people don't want to talk because if they talk about it, they'll have to see somebody else's perspective. They'll have to admit that change needs to be made, and they don't want to make a change.
Right.
And they don't care if somebody else is uncomfortable.
Right. And so part of the letting go, there is some letting go involved here. Sometimes we have to let go of our own agendas and say, okay, maybe we need to do it for a while where it isn't the best possible way, but we're going to do it this way. And then at some point, maybe things will ease up and we can try something different. So, you know, there's not just a surrender for the other person, but sometimes we have to surrender, and if we wait and let go, then a new doorway opens and a new possibility shows up.
Well, not talking, not discussing, not seeing the other person's side of it. They're really important issues.
Yes, they're huge issues.
And we have,
and they're probably some of the issues that were true in this relationship that ended. And I think people very often, when a relationship ends, they think, oh, well, you know, now that we're divorced, we will have the conversation. Now we'll have the conversation we never had when we were married. And, of course, that's dreaming. It doesn't happen. So you need to creatively try to find a solution. You know, either work with it as it is and you know, hope that as time it gets better and keep moving it in a better path, or accept that it's not going to be in the ideal way that you want yourself. I think we all want solutions immediately, which brings me to another chapter of the book, is that, you know, solutions aren't immediate. They don't, very rarely do they come all at once. Bam, there's a solution. I'll never have to think about the problem again. It's a process. It's a process of persistence. Okay, I'm going to try this. Okay, I'm going to see that he doesn't want to talk about it, but I'm going to do the best that I can with what we've set up for now and see how I can maneuver that later, you know, see if there's any, you know, new opening or new opportunity for shifting it. I think that's a very important step in the process of any crisis, is that it is a process, and we forget that. I think we especially forget that in this modern world where we can have everything on a minute's notice. We can have everything on a minute's notice, and so we think anything we want we can have on a minute's notice. But the truth is that many things are a process. You know, you have to go through something. You have to go forward and you have to go backward in order to make it to your ultimate destination.
We have a computer program called Nano Voice, N-A-N-O Voice, and you can download it at nanovoice.org for people listening. But we get people in here who are asking us, you know, the same kind of thing, what do I do next? And when you boil it down, what they really want is to reject the behavior but keep the person.
Right, exactly.
They don't go hand in hand. So this little program can help them. And sometimes it's a really small.
How can it help, Sherry? That's very interesting. What is it called? It's called Nano what?
Nano Voice. N-A-N-O Voice. And we've had people in here, you know, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. Well, as they talk, the computer program tells them where they're having problems, what area. Maybe it's the note of C, their ego, or F, they don't have a plan. So
interesting. How interesting.
It's an automatic printout. So if they have these kinds of issues, they can talk, and the computer will give them some information about it. You know,
that is a wonderful resource. I'm really happy. It's called nanovoice.com.
Well, it's .org.
.org. Interesting.
So
you're suggesting that as a particular resource, that might be very helpful to this woman.
Yes, and we give this away to the public. They won't even ask your name. There's no commercials. It's automatic. It doesn't work well with a Mac unless you read the instructions first, but it's all right there for people. And this is one of the things we at this research center want to really help people with, is to find their authentic self without all of these shoulds and oughts and whatever. Because it can be some really small issue
by
standards, but to them it's a biggie.
Yes, and from that awareness, you know, we've talked a lot about developing self-awareness, and from that awareness, a different response can be created, especially when you have this kind of feedback. That's a wonderful resource.
Well, thank you. I will make sure that you get a copy if you'd like.
Thank you. I'd really appreciate that, Sherry. Sounds wonderful. And I love the word voice in it, because I think we're all looking for our true voice, you know, the voice that speaks our truth and allows us to live authentically in connection with that voice, you know, in alignment with that voice.
Well, that's what we were talking about, at Richard and I, at the top of the show, when we had done something on Nancy Pelosi, when she called Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary, called him a liar. And he we used the voice print on him. He was telling the truth. It's Nancy Pelosi that's the liar and the bully.
Oh, so, wow. Interesting. Interesting.
We put the whole framework of that out on YouTube so people can see the pictures of it. We have about 15 minutes or so left, and this is from Sandy L., and she says, I know this is a small thing, but it really is a problem in our relationship. My husband interrupts me, his mother, our kids, his boss, anyone, anything. I know this probably isn't a big problem to some people, but in capital letters, I feel this is ruining our marriage. I've talked to him and how rude and inconsiderate this is. He says I'm making a big deal out of nothing, but I can't get one sentence out without him interrupting me. He says he interrupts because he's trying to save time, but he knows what I'm going to say. 99% of the time he doesn't know what I'm going to say, and then he insists that I change what I was going to say to make him wrong. We recently served on a neighborhood committee. After the first meeting, several of the members asked me to leave him home next time.
Wow.
Because his interruptions were not productive, and his lack of respect for others made people uncomfortable. Do you have any suggestions on how I could handle this?
First of all, I'd just like to say that that is not a little thing. It's a huge behavioral thing, and it's very disrespectful, and it also reveals, you know, a lot of psychological issues with this person, which I won't get into, but they're, you know, they're emotional reasons why we develop our behaviors. Again, chapter two, I talk to people about their kind of habitual behaviors. But again, to the woman writing this, I would say, what would be a different approach you could say to him? One is to write a letter, because obviously he's not a person who listens to spoken words. One is to write a letter. One is to ask yourself the question of how big is this really for me and what am I willing to let go of, you know? Am I willing to let it be okay that I'm interrupted? Am I willing to let go of this man? What do I need to let go of? I mean, I think sometimes people don't change behavior until somebody says to them, you know, you're going to lose me if you don't change this behavior. This is doesn't matter what you say about it. It's a big deal. It could be a deal breaker. And so, you know, just as you said, Sherry, with your grandson, you know, when you finally change what you communicate, when you change your own behavior, then people are taken aback by it and they sometimes try to punish you for it. But the truth is the energy shifts and something new happens. So I think this woman, I would encourage her to take a new form of behavior herself in response, because obviously he's not listening. He's just arguing. It's like, well, these are my reasons and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Maybe include some of those comments from the people, because that's, you know, that's a significant piece of information. And see if a letter rather than a, you know, a letter rather than a verbal communication has any impact. And again, it's a process. It's not going to all happen in one time. It's like, see where that leads.
Do you think this is just a power trip? He wants to be in control?
I think people who are interrupters usually have some real issues with self-esteem, or they may have been children who were not listened to themselves, and so they are desperate to be listened to, and until they do what I call the psychological work, the emotional healing work of self-awareness, and I can't say that, I could say that 2 million times, and it still wouldn't be enough. Until they do the work of psychological awareness, they're not going to change their behavior unless somebody else says, listen, this is no longer acceptable to me, and I'm going to change my behavior. The next time you interrupt, I'm not going to be in this room anymore, or the next time you interrupt, I'm not going to be in this house anymore, or whatever, you know. But that kind of behavior, especially when it's been discussed, is very significant. I'll say that about it.
Well, you said one sentence there that sometimes people try to punish you for saying something.
Yes.
Now, my observation with that is if somebody's trying to punish you, they're trying to train you to say that to them again, and that's all the more reason to come back and say it in a different way.
Exactly, exactly. And they're trying to intimidate you so that you don't change your behavior. But the truth is, you know, this is a real relationship problem. It's not the way to treat a person you love or care about or want to share your life with.
There's something from my own life that I have learned about accepting or leaving. If my husband does something and he's not going to change and he shows me that I'm not going to change, he's not going to change, then I need to accept that behavior totally or I need to get out.
And yes, I think exactly.
It starts when people try to punish each other. It's like when he asked me to go to a party, and I hate parties. If I agree to go to the party, I will go and be totally there and totally with it. I won't go to the party and be a butt and try to punish him.
Right, exactly. That's the acceptance mode. It's like, okay, I've chosen to accept this, and therefore I'm going to be fully present with it. You can't, and that's right. I love this distinction, Sherry. I think it's great because you either have to say, it's okay enough that I can live with it, I accept it, or it's so not okay that I can't accept it, and therefore I must remove myself. So that's a good question for people to ask themselves. Is this something I can accept? Can I find a way in my heart and my being and my reality to accept this and get comfortable with it? Or is it so big that I can't accept it and I really need to move on?
I think that's one of the reasons a lot of relationships break up, because they try to punish each other for things that they can't accept, and it just gets worse and worse, and the things get smaller and smaller as to what's going on.
Right, and so basically maybe they wanted to leave, but they didn't have the courage to leave, so they just create such a chaotic, horrible situation that it all ends up falling apart. So I love your method, and I think it's a really great one. And, of course, as we know, leaving involves letting go, and once again, I'm saying this again, too, it's hard to let go. We'd rather punish somebody, or we'd rather complain, or we'd rather not do the work of acceptance than let go, because it's a hard thing to do.
I don't know where I read this, but it was something like, if you're holding a grudge against somebody, it's like you drink the poison and hope that they die.
That's great. Yes, that's a good one. So we have to be willing to get clear about what's important for us, you know? And, of course, getting clear is a process, too. Sometimes that's very difficult to say, this is more important than this, and this is where my boundary line is. This is where I can't go any further. And again, that's a process of self-awareness. I wear glasses, and every time I have my eyes checked and the optometrist or whatever says, is this clear or is this clear? It's like, you know, there's this decision over and over again. No, this is better than this. This is acceptable. This isn't. This is acceptable. This isn't. And we're all in a process of, you know, asking ourselves that about many things in our lives at any moment. Is this amount of credit card debt acceptable, or am I going to cut up my credit card? Is the way my husband's treating me acceptable, or I'm going to leave? Is my job acceptable, or would I rather start a business of my own? Is, you know, living in poverty acceptable, or do I want to go and get a job? And, you know, we have millions of questions like this that we're all constantly needing to ask ourselves and get clarity about.
There's two things I want to ask you about, and we have 5 minutes left, Chapter 1 and Chapter 9. Chapter 1, Richard and I were talking before the show, and just cry your heart out is not a thing that I would ever do. I think people would describe me as being stoic. I would go do something about it. To me, I feel, just for me, crying never helped the situation for me. Getting up and doing something did. So do people.
Well, you're clearly a person of action, Sherry. I can feel that in many respects. And so for you, the chapter Do Something Different would be more in keeping with your personality type. But I just to say one or two sentences about that. When people are overwhelmed emotionally by difficult circumstances, it really is important to allow themselves to cry. And if the crying is coming up, it sounds like for you that isn't what happens. But very often when it does come up for people, they say, oh, I shouldn't be doing this, or I'm sorry, or, you know, instead of realizing that if you are an emotional type person and the tears are coming, it's really okay to cry them, because that's part of a healing process, and it's part of regaining equilibrium.
Do you think it's harder for men to cry like this?
Much harder, much, much harder. And that's why it really came out as, you know, as I told you, it was a man who asked me to offer these things. And so, you know, he was having a very hard time grieving about the loss of his wife. And, you know, that's a very important part of the healing and moving on process, to grieve, to allow the tears to come.
Richard, do you have a perspective about this?
You can, yes, I do. Well, my question is, I understand that's a whole other show talking about the culture or the anthropological setup that got it,
yes,
where it's hard for men to express themselves. That's a whole different show. I was really talking with Sherry before. I'm not necessarily stoic by nature, but I'm what people might call excessively jolly, even though
wonderful,
like corrects it, or, you know, whatever. I always have that other side to it, but I would have a very difficult time getting to the crying stage, what I would call the crying stage. I can express myself verbally, I can talk about things, but it's always been very difficult for me to find the trigger to get myself to cry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the real message here is not make yourself cry, but the message is, and there are various types of people. Some are action thinking types and some are emotional feeling types. And just the important thing is, if you are brought to that place of tears, to accept it and to say, this is okay. For me, this is part of the healing process, and I don't need to deny that. I can let that be a part of the journey, whether I'm a man or a woman, because it's a very organic process that the body invites as a way of healing and moving beyond things. It's not a crime if you don't cry. I feel like I'm talking to two very powerful action people, very inspiring. You know, this is a way of responding, but for people who get into deep emotional waters and they feel the tears coming up, the message is, it's okay to do this.
And so therefore, that I'm extrapolating that out, that means that for people such as Sherry or I myself, who don't necessarily go to the crying, that we also can give ourselves that acknowledgement of, we just do it differently, but it's a release as well?
Absolutely. And
okay.
And that you have a form of release energetically, it sounds like, of taking action, both of you. And, you know, other people have a form of release of letting the feeling go through them, and then they can take the action.
You only have
both are okay. It's just that in our culture, I think we're so hard on ourselves about crying when that's the thing that's needed. And I just wanted to really let people know, if that's what's coming up for you, don't deny it, because that's a real part of the healing process.
go to Amazon, buy this book, and on the back you'll find a quote from Marianne Williamson, who I love. Anyone going through the dark night of the soul needs to have this book. It will be your closest companion and your most tender angel. Daphne Rose Kingma more than speaks to your soul. She knows how to heal. We are going to go on just a little bit after the show, but we have to get an official ending. Thank you for joining us. Please join us next week, and please go buy this book. I think it's going to be very, very important. Okay, we are off the air, but we are still recording for the archives. And one of the things that I wanted to add about this book, Daphne, is I love Chapter 9.
Thank you.
I think that's where people really make it through, going to where the love is, going to where they're accepted, if it's God, if it's your mother, if it's your friend, somewhere where you can really just be you and open up and sort of find a foundation to start over. So I wanted to add that, and we just didn't have time.
Yes, that's so true, because, of course, love is what transforms our life and lifts our spirits, and even in the darkest hours of crisis, there are people we can go to and circumstances that we can invite ourselves to be in that make us feel loved and connected and cared for, and that makes all the difference.
And I think with that comes the acceptance, and that's what people need, that their life has been interrupted with non-acceptance, and so
yes,
you go where the love is, and that's where your acceptance is.
Thank yes, and there's a lot of peace and beauty that transforms the painful experience, too. Yes, of course, I always love to write about love because that's my path, and it's been what all my other books have been about. And, of course, when you're in a difficult time, you need love more than ever otherwise. So,
well, thank you, Daphne.
Yes.
Thank you, Richard O., for being with us and handling the chat line. Thank all of our listeners. And we're going to sign off now, if I can find the information that tells me how to sign off.
Thank you,
great,
Sherry.
Thank
you, Richard.
Thank you. Thank you, Daphne. That was fun.
You know,
lovely.
Every time they change this, and there should be a thing on here that says that we can quit the show. Shannon, do you see this? Show is on, but not streaming. We up here, it usually says end the show.
Daphne, do you have any audiobooks?
I have two audiobooks. One is called The Many Faces of Love, which is about, based on my book, The Future of Love. It's about the changing nature of relationships, and another one called The Breakup Bible. I don't like the title of that one very well, but that is about ending relationships, and they're both published by Sounds True Publishing.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great.
Yes. And, yes, it was lovely to be with both of you today. Really a pleasure.
Yeah, that was very good.
Thank you, Richard.
As I say, that's such an interesting anthropological or sociological. I'm not sure, actually. I think it's actually more sociological. That issue about, you know, the difficulty that men have crying being a man. Overly feminized in that, you know, I mean, I have all those characteristics, and yet I still have that difficulty getting to the crying place, and I guess I've transformed that more into an action position.
Mm-hmm.
My action tends to be talking, because that's what I do.
Yes,
so
you
I've
do it very well.
Thank you.
I really appreciated many of the things you were saying, and
okay,
I think it's just that when I think I wrote a book about men, and I think that often women are not very accepting of men when they're in that tender place. You know, it's like, well, why are you crying? You're the guy who's supposed to hold the world together, you know.
Well,
don't you have
that's
a breakdown?
That double,
don't.
That's that, weird, that is that weird double-edged sword that we have.
It is.
Of the men are supposed to be, I mean, and it's almost, I'll say genetic, but in a certain sense, that we're supposed to be the protectors, we're supposed to be the brave ones, we're supposed to be the, you know, that thing. And that's, again, that's like a whole but yet another show where I think that is such an issue, I think, that we have in our society, where we have this weird thing happening where we have women in the world who are now acting like men, and we have men who are just all confused because they're supposed to be all tender and metrosexual and all, you know, warm and fuzzy, but really we're still supposed to be going out and clubbing the dinosaur over the head and bringing it back to the cave and feeding it.
Exactly. Well, I think it puts men in a terrible double bind, and that's why I wrote that. But we should have a conversation about that sometime. It's called The Men We Never Knew, and it's about that double bind that men are in. And I think men are the protectors, and they do need to do those things. That's part of the function. But when life takes them apart, or when they need to be tender, or when they need to be nurtured, they have a right to be that too. And I just think a lot of women don't create that space for men. I think it's really a change that needs to happen in women. That's what I'm really talking about.
Are you familiar with Alison Armstrong's work?
No, I'm not.
Okay. She does some very interesting workshops sort of around that, although she's more founded, again, in the tell men what you want and how they can help you having that, if that statement makes sense.
Uh-huh, I understand
that's like
that.
That's like a little tiny cliff notes of what Allison's work is.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's true, but I think that men also need to be able to not always be holding up the whole world, you know, and to not lose their dignity when they, you know, when they don't. I mean, it's like saying, well, a woman should never wear pantsuits, you know.
Yeah.
Personally, I don't wear pantsuits. But, you know, I mean, I think it's very unequal. I think it's very unequal. You know, women are supposed to have as much money as men and run the corporations and wear pantsuits.
Mm-hmm.
But
if
men have a weak moment, then they're idiots and we're not going to support
weak.
Them.
Well, just as it's exactly what you said right there, then they're weak.
Exactly.
That's what
so I
is
think
that if you cry as a man, then you are perceived as weak or vulnerable.
Right. And I just, we're talking about one of my favorite topics because I wrote that book really wishing and hoping to educate the women of the world to be more sensitive to the men of the world, you know? Because
I
that think
women. As one of those
thank
men.
Thank you. Well,
I
let's
love
have a
conversation.
I'd love to have a deeper conversation about that sometime. So it's been just really a joy to be with both of you, and I look forward to connecting with you again in the future. And I don't know if Sherry's still on.
I'm here.
But
she must
hi,
be because
Sherry.
We're still talking.
Oh, great. And I love that nano voice thing. That sounds really interesting.
We will send you one.
And do you have my email contact, or you have a way to send it to me?
Do we need your email? We need your email.
Okay, it's DaphneKingma@yahoo.com.
Okay, we'll just send you the link.
Great, that's wonderful. It's just been really a joy to be with you, and I look forward to talking with you sometime in the future.
We will. We didn't get through all 10. We'll have you back.
Okay, great. I look forward to it so much, Sherry and Richard. Have a great day.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks,
Daphne.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
And have you figured out how to hang up the show yet?